Thank you. I know my girl said they never fix it for me. Anyway, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to all. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. Our good tradition states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere, so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group's Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of December 3rd, 2010. He has been continually in service as literature person, treasurer, secretary, CSR, as well as a sponsor. His favorite AA motto, which I love this one, is contempt prior to investigation. And we've been waiting for this all day. May I have them go, please? Thank you. The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week award is Mark G. from Visalia. Thanks, guys.
I really don't know what to say. This is worth $2.19. I order them online. I know exactly what they cost. My name's Mark, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am grateful that Bill H. gave me the opportunity to address this group. I love this group. It's one of my home groups. I've been involved with these beautiful people that run this outfit for about a year and a half. So I'm going to share a little of my experience, strength, and hope with y'all. I'm a drunk. I'm an alcoholic. And I was born in a good city to be a drunk in, San Francisco, California. I lived there for 24 years. And I come from a CIA family. I didn't make that up. I heard it on a speaker tape. A CIA family. Catholic, Irish, alcoholic. There's a lot of CIA families in the neighborhood I grew up in. I grew up in the west side of San Francisco, which is called the Sunset District, because the sun sets there. It's near the ocean. If any of you have been to the San Francisco Zoo, I lived about two blocks from there. I grew up in a family, an Irish Catholic family with seven kids. I was the second oldest. My father's an alcoholic. And everybody I knew that was over the age of 21, every adult, both drank and smoked cigarettes. That was normal. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. My dad, he had a lot of trouble with alcohol, but you didn't talk about that kind of trouble in those days. There were several times when instead of having two cars in the driveway, we would have one. The other one would never reappear. And we weren't to ask what happened to that car. Several times my mother would wake us kids up in the middle of the night and still in our pajamas tell us to get in the car and we would drive to the police station or the emergency hospital and pick up Dad. But you weren't allowed to ask why. I was in that kind of family, you don't ask a lot of questions. You know, our routine was when my dad came home from work, it was a quiet time in the house. He hated noise. That is a family of seven kids and he hates noise. Go figure. But that was his drinking time. So it was a time where if you were going to play or watch television, you had to keep it a low volume because if you exceeded his acceptable noise level, he'd stomp, stomp, stomp down the stairs and take the belt to you. We thought that was normal. In that environment, I never heard anybody mention anything about a drinking problem. When my parents' friends would come over, everybody drank. As a little kid, one of your jobs is to carry drinks from the kitchen into the living room, drink the excess if there's any. That all seemed normal to me. To say somebody was alcoholic, I never heard that phrase used. And even though we grew up in an alcoholic household, it seemed normal to me. I didn't know how other people lived, so it all seemed pretty good. And I really, as a kid, I had a good time. I went to Catholic schools through high school. I know a lot of people have bad experiences in that school system, but I liked it. It was easy. Everything was spoon-fed. You didn't have to decide what to wear to school because everybody wore the same thing. You didn't have to make any decisions in school. They were all made for you. So it was easy. Things changed for me in high school because prior to that, I had just had observed other people drinking. When I was a sophomore in high school, my turn came. I was at a New Year's Eve party, a New Year's Eve between 70 and 71, which is a really good time to be in San Francisco. So I go to the New Year's Eve party, and one of the older guys volunteers to make a beer run. I don't know what to order. I don't know anything about beer except what I've seen on TV commercials. And at the time, the best TV commercials were run by the Olympia Brewery in Tumwater, Washington. So I said, I'll have a six-pack of Ole. And I thought, you drink Ole? I guess. Well, I drank Ole that night. And after two or three of those beers, I felt like this is the greatest thing I have ever experienced. It felt absolutely wonderful. And it made me understand why people drink all the time, because it feels great. And I wasn't one of those guys that drank because I felt like I didn't fit in, or I was insecure, or I didn't feel as good as the other kids. I fit in. I played sports. I was a good student. I was part of the in-group at every school I went to. I drank because it felt good and it made fun way more fun. Whatever you were doing was better if you had some booze involved. And I absolutely loved it. And the hangover the next day I absolutely didn't care about. It was worth it. And so from that moment on, anytime I had a chance, we'd go get some beer to do whatever we were doing in high school. After the game, after the dance, before the dance, there's going to be booze, because what was the point of trying to have fun without it? Make no sense. And it was easy to get. You know, most liquor stores in San Francisco, they didn't care what age you were. As long as you looked reasonably close to 21, they would sell you whatever you wanted. It wasn't a problem. I not only love to drink and I love the effect, I love the taste too. When people say, well, I started drinking beer, I hated the taste. I thought it was terrific. I thought everything was terrific. So I don't get when people say, well, I hated the taste of it, but I got used to it. That's a negative. I loved it from the first time. I loved the taste. I loved the effect. I loved the experience. Now, when I was a junior in high school, my life took both a good and a bad turn. And my dad was always getting into trouble. And he would work a job for a certain number of years, and then all of a sudden he wouldn't be going to work, and the only explanation ever offered was, well, it just didn't work out. So he kept getting fired. And then one of the jobs that just didn't work out, and we didn't find this out until later, but he stole a bunch of money. He was an accountant, and he was a controller for a cement company in South San Francisco. And he stole, the dollar amount in 1971 was $100,000. I don't know what that would be now. But the people that ran the company gave him a choice. You can either pay the money back or we're going to call the cops. Well, he paid the money back by taking a second mortgage on our house and bankrupting our savings, and then he left for good. He just took off. So that was bad, because we didn't have any money. But it was good because he wasn't around. Now, my youngest brothers and sisters were like 5, 6, 8, and 9 years old. I was in junior high school. I was 16. And I just got my license. Now, since he was gone and the family needed money, I got to do two things. I got to get a job, and I got to take over the payments on a van, a 1968 GMC Handy van. It seated 8. The payments were $68 a month. My first job was working in a liquor store. The CD Liquors on 40th and Terravel in San Francisco. It's still there. Now, my job was I'd go in after school. I would stock the walk-in. Make sure you pull all the bottles on the shelves, restock all the shelves, and I'd start making deliveries. Because in those days, every liquor store, any place that sold liquor, had to charge the same price. They call it a fair trade law. So the corner liquor store charged $1.32 for a six-pack of Budweiser. There's no 12-packs in those days. And that was the same price that the Safeway charged, or anywhere else. That was the law. So corner liquor stores did real good. So they delivered for free. And that was the other part of my job. I delivered booze all over the west side of San Francisco. And it was a hell of a good job. Because drunk people tip a lot. And the bigger the party and the more the booze and the drunker the people, the bigger tips I got. They just hand me wads of money. He says, is that right? Absolutely. So I got a good paycheck, plus I came home with cash money in my pocket every night. And I had unlimited access to booze. Because if I wanted to buy booze for myself, I would just call in an order and go deliver to me. I didn't get a check, but what the hell, I got the booze. So here I am, 16 years old, I love to drink, I got a van, I work in a liquor store in San Francisco. Well, that's a pretty good life. And I stayed out of trouble. It was a good deal, but my life, my entire life, was involved with alcohol in some way. All my recreation, all my work, and I didn't consider that to be abnormal. Everybody I knew drank. Drinking was recreation. After football season, because I played football, if somebody said, what are you doing tonight? Doing meant how much you're drinking and what is it? So the answer to doing might be 2 six-packs. Or 6-pack of Talls and a half a pint of Bourbon Deluxe. That's what we're doing. Drinking was the activity in and of itself. We had places around the city we'd drink at that we had to rotate so the cops wouldn't catch on to you. Sometimes you go down to the beach, sometimes you go to the Golden Gate Park, sometimes you go down to the marina, and just a bunch of people from different high schools get together and get drunk. No other activity is necessary. Drinking is the activity. That's the fun. And that's the way I looked at it. We didn't drink in conjunction with things. We drank to drink. That was the whole point. I considered that normal, and I liked it. Now, with that drinking habit, I was able to manage it for a number of years. So I went to college. I went to San Francisco State because it was close and it was cheap. I got good jobs. I always got jobs I wanted. Once I got out of the liquor thing, you know, I got this job working for Department of Forestry up in Northern California because I read an article in the newspaper, in the Sunday paper, about how exciting it was to fight fires. So I said, well, I want to do that. I didn't know anybody in the firefighting business. Didn't know anything about it, but I put in an application, I got the job. I did that for the next 7 years. That's how I got through college. Go to Northern California summers, fight fires, make a little money, come back, and go to college. And I drank all this time, but I was busy. And I liked being busy. So I didn't get into any trouble. But I still was living a life where alcohol was involved in every recreational activity that I did, which I considered normal. I like to fish. I like to hike. I like to go to sporting events. I like to camp. I would not do any of those things without alcohol. That would seem absurd. To go to a ball game and not get drunk? Really, what is the point of that? To have a barbecue and not get smashed? What would the point of that be? And I felt sorry for people that didn't drink. I knew a few. But I see somebody drinking root beer at a barbecue, I think, you poor bastard. I even asked one guy, I said, why are you drinking root beer? Are you sick or something? He's just not in a drink. I just thought, oh, man. I felt bad for him. To miss out on that exquisite joy that you get from that buzz, what a terrible and deprived life. And that's the attitude I had. But as I went on in life, I was able to discipline myself enough to take care of the things I wanted to take care of. So I finished college and I got a useless degree. It is useless. I got a degree in television. And I worked in television for a little bit. Not the kind of television that's any fun. I was an assistant producer in charge of public service programming for a station in San Jose. Now, public service programming is how they fulfill their FCC requirements. So those are those shows that are on at 7 a.m. on Sunday that absolutely nobody watches. Welcome to Community Forum. And then you'd have somebody on there that wanted to talk about you know, this is the latest trash pickup or the latest pet rescue operation or something thrilling like that. And that's how I got that job, because those programs don't generate any money for the station, because you can't sell the commercial time except used car outfits and bail bonds, and they're the only people that buy those commercials. So that was my fling with show business. But I didn't like it anyway, so I got another job that I did like. And it was a great job. It took me all over the state. It was exciting. I got to work in Sacramento, Los Angeles, and Santa Barbara, and I ended up here. And I also did other things along the way that you're supposed to do if you got a good job and stuff. Like I met a beautiful woman and married her. And we had a couple beautiful kids. And we got us a nice house, and we got some cars, and we got all the stuff you're supposed to do. But I still like to drink a lot. But I also like my life a lot. And I was in a job where you couldn't drink all the time, because if you show up work drunk or hungover, they're going to fire you. And they can do mandatory random testing anytime they want. And everybody knows this, so you got to keep your nose clean if you want to keep your job. And I did. But on the weekends, get ready, folks. My thing used to be, I'm going to take care of everything that I need to do during the work week. If I got errands to run, if I got banking to do, if I got yard work to do, if I got cars to wash, I'm going to do that during my work week, because my weekends have to be absolutely free. And I would stockpile all the booze and food I'm going to need for my days off and drink myself into a stupor. Weekend alcoholic. Now, I didn't look at it that way. The job I was in was stressful, a lot of pressure to produce. So, as a way of relieving stress, either me alone or me and my friends, we'd get shit-faced drunk as a form of stress relief. And I believed it worked. See, you go out with your friends on a weekend and get really drunk and hoot and holler and howl with the moon, you get all that stress out that you built up during the week. And then you can go back to work and you're okay. And I did that for a long time, and I believed it worked. Not a lot of other people did, but I believed it worked. And I did that for a long time, and people would suggest that maybe I had a drinking problem. My wife, mother, my brothers, later on my children. But that's simply because they didn't understand what kind of pressures and stress I have to deal with. And I forgave them for that. But it didn't change the way I drank. I still loved it. And as you get older and you start to acquire stuff, drinking is easier. If you really want to be a good drunk, get an RV. Because I got this old RV, and it's got 10,000 compartments inside and outside. And nobody knows what's in them except me. Nobody knows that there's spaces underneath the gas refrigerator and underneath the sink and where you keep the propane. There's plenty of room in all those places. And there was bottles in all of them. In fact, that guy I finally sold the RV to, he's probably still finding shit in there after 10 years. So it's a good deal, because even when I wasn't driving the RV, I always had it in the driveway, and you know, if I wanted a drink and when company was over or I didn't want my wife to see me, I'm going to go out and work in the RV a little bit. Routine maintenance. So I had all kinds of good deals going on because I like to drink so much, but I didn't like to drink in front of people the amount, because as I progressed as an alcoholic, it took more and more for me to feel the effects. So I had public drinking and private drinking. So if I'm having people over for dinner or for a holiday, I would have wine and beer and stuff available for people to drink. And I would drink that, and plus whatever else I had hidden. So it would seem like I was drinking the same amount as other people. But I was drinking two or three or times as much because I had to get the same effect. And just like every time we would go out to a dinner, a party, or just even to a restaurant, I would drink a lot before we left. Because if I get to the restaurant and I have to drink there, I'm going to be drinking, ordering drinks two and three at a time to get as much as I want. Restaurant's expensive in a restaurant. So I keep a bottle at the house, and I drink a bunch of that before I go out to pre-drink prior to the event. Because it's cost-effective, and it also saves my reputation, because my reputation is very important to me. And it didn't do any good for my reputation, you know, on those occasions when my wife would find me passed out naked on the patio and stuff, but those were just occasional slips. Now, eventually she got tired of that crap, and she left. She moved over to Vegas and started a new life for herself, which I made no connection to her leaving and the way I was living. It's all on her. And it took me a long time when I started working the steps to get clear on what my part in that was. But she left, and then now I got two kids there at the house, and so that was okay. Actually real good for me, because it saved me from being a complete alcoholic for several more years, because being a single parent, I had a lot to do. I was working full time, I had these kids to take care of, but I didn't have a whole lot of time for drinking, so I kept it in control until I retired. Once I had 30 years into my job, and they told me that if you don't want to come back to work anymore, you don't have to, and we'll just give you a check every month. And I said, okay. So I did, and it was a cool deal, because I always envisioned when I retire, I'd be able to take it easy and just sit on my patio and read good books and drink gin and tonics, and I wouldn't have to worry about going to work, and I wouldn't have to worry about all these other responsibilities. And that worked for a while. But I was like that guy that's described in the Big Book. He kept his drinking under control for 25 years, and then he retired. He put on his carpet slippers and picked up the bottle. That's pretty much what I did. Because I found that without this structure of work and family responsibilities, and of course my wife was long gone, I didn't have anything to do except drink. So cocktail hour went from 5 p.m. to 3 p.m. to noon to whenever you get up in the morning. And it didn't take very long for me to become a 24-hour a day, 7-day a week drunk. And I really didn't know how it happened, because I was this cool guy that liked to go to barbecues and get drunk on weekends, and now I'm drunk all the time. Never occurred to me I might be an alcoholic. That was for other people. I certainly knew a lot of alcoholics. But it couldn't be me. So I quit. Now, I had quit before in my life, depending on what my family and work circumstances were. Once I quit drinking for 3 years because I thought it would be the right thing to do. And I thought I was okay. Everybody else thought I was an asshole. But I didn't drink for 3 years. And that told me I got some willpower. So now I retired and I become a full-time drunk. I thought, well, I got willpower, and I demonstrated that years ago, and I can quit again, and I did. For a couple weeks. And I was miserable. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't focus. I couldn't have fun in anything. And I had way too much time on my hands. So, of course, like any good alcoholic, if I just drink beer, because I really like beer. I mean, I used to make beer, bottle my own beer. If I just drink beer, I should be okay, because it's that hard liquor that causes the problems. And I drank beer for a couple of days. But it just doesn't, you know, if you're an alcoholic, it just doesn't work. You got to have more and more. So I go back on these runs, staying drunk 24/7 for a week or more, and then I'd sober up and say, man, I can't do this. I got to find a way not to drink. And I don't want to be an alcoholic, because I know they have to go to meetings, and I don't want to go to meetings. So I went to a shrink. Now, I had been without a drink for probably a month. Now I'm going nuts. I'm as stressed out as I've ever been. I can't sleep, and I'm miserable, and I'm tortured, and all I do is think about drinking. So I go to a shrink, and I tell him what's going on, and he says, well, why did you quit drinking? And I said, well, I think I was drinking too much. And I told him what my drinking pattern was, and he says, well, do you think you might be an alcoholic? Well, I don't know. I don't think so. He says, well, do you have any history of it in your family? Well, my dad is an alcoholic, and his dad died of alcoholism, and my mother's dad died of alcoholism. See, there's 7 kids in the family, and 5 of them are in AA. Yeah, I think he does run in the family. So we talked a little more, and I kept going. I went to him like once every 2 weeks, I think. I'd always feel real good when I left his office, and I think I'm getting a hold of my problems. I probably had male problems, which I do, but I thought that's why I was tortured by trying to stop drinking. So after a couple of visits, I'd go in there, and he gives me a business card, and it's for Family Recovery Center here in Visalia. And I said, well, what's this? He goes, well, this is a group that you can go to, and you can talk to some of the people in that group, because I think you find you have a lot in common with them. And I said, well, I thought we were doing our good work here. And he goes, well, we're doing good in our sessions, but I think you get a lot of benefit out of going to this group. Well, it's an alcohol recovery joint. I'm like, well, I'm not going to go there. So I thanked the doctor for his advice and took the card home and threw it in the garbage. I just didn't think that was my problem. Well, I was sober 4 months that way. And during that 4 months, because since he had suggested that I might be an alcoholic, I had a big book. And I read it. And I thought, well, I may not be an alcoholic, but there might be some good stuff in here that will relieve some of the torture I'm having about not drinking. So I read the big book, and I started keeping a journal every day about my thoughts, about trying to quit. And I thought those 12 steps might be a pretty good foundation, so I did the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in the privacy of my own home. But because my case was not that severe, I didn't need to do all of them. And the ones I did were qualified. For example, step 1 says, I admitted I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. And I changed to that to, I admitted that at times I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become somewhat unmanageable. Now, when I got to step 2, I came to believe in a power greater than myself and the storm of insanity. First of all, I'm not insane. And the second thing is, I don't believe in God. And I can't do that. I was an agnostic when I tried to get sober. I'm an agnostic. I don't believe in God. I went to Catholic school through high school. I abandoned that faith a long time ago. I wasn't going back to it. So I'm not doing the God thing, which made it real difficult to do step 3. I wasn't going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, because I thought I had done a pretty decent job up until then, except for the drinking thing. So I'm not going to do that. But I did the inventory part. Then I get to the 5th step, where it says you have to admit to God, yourself, and another human being the exact nature of your wrongs. Well, I can admit it to God, assuming there was one. To myself, sure. To another human being, no. So I didn't get a sponsor, because I'm not going to tell somebody else all my crap. Sounds like confession to me. Well, here in the Catholic educational system, you go to confession. It's the second of the 7 sacraments versus baptism. Now, when I was a kid in Catholic school, we were given training on confession. How are you going to go into the priest and confess your sins? We're in second grade or something. We were like 6 years old. So I get together with my buddies, and we're talking about going into confession. So we're having a discussion. What are you going to say? I don't know. What are you going to say? Now, our thing was, we can't say anything real bad, because even though it's supposed to be an anonymous process, I know that's Father Donworth over there on the other side, and he knows who I am, because he baptized me, and he comes over to my house all the time and drinks with my parents. So I'm not going to tell him shit. So we get a plan together. We're going to think up sins that are kind of bad and not too bad. So you figure out stuff to say. Well, I'm going to say I disobeyed my parents and I hit my brother. So we would go in there and say that crap. You know, okay, say five hours rather than 10. You know, married. I don't go to the country. I don't receive it. I wrote it on. Because that's what it all sounded like. When Father Don was spoke, he couldn't understand a goddamn thing he said, but it was fine. He was like, right, I don't have to five Hail Marys. I don't go to the country. I don't go to the country. And you're good for a week. So that's what I thought of confession. So if I'm going to have to confess my shortcomings, I'm just not going to do it. I'm just going to pass on that. And I have a written record of my working of the 12 steps. When I got to the ninth step, my ninth step, then I wrote in there that, you know, I probably should talk to an AA sponsor about doing these amends, because I'm really not sure how to go about that. But I didn't. So I didn't do it. So that was my version of the 12 steps. So after 4 months of this half-assed stuff, I'm out mowing my lawn one day, and I said, I am so miserable. I don't see the point of abstaining from alcohol. Anything has to be better than this. It's legal to drink. I got money to drink. I'm going to go drink. And I did, and I stayed drunk for months. In my room, sucking vodka straight out of the bottle. That was my social drinking. Watching endless reruns of NCIS. I had the first 8 seasons on tape. And it's a good deal, because there's no reruns if you're drunk enough. You don't remember you saw that shit. It's all new. And I would stay in there for days and days until I ran out of booze, and then I would do my undercover shopping. Because I got a reputation to protect. I'm a middle-class guy. Now, you can't lay around in your room drunk for 4 or 5 days and then go to the supermarket. Now, you probably could go to the corner liquor, but I wasn't going to do that because I got an image to think about. So when I needed booze, I'd get all shined up. I go in and take a shower and I shave and I put on nice clothes. Then I go into the Save Mart and get a shopping cart. And buy groceries I didn't need. Healthy stuff that I wasn't going to eat. Couple bags of salad, granola bars, yogurt, bananas, and all this stuff. Oh, vodka! And this shit's on sale! The 1.75 liter bottle, I better get 2 of them. Stocking up. Then I get back home and throw that shit on the counter and go back and drink my vodka and watch NCIS. Yeah, I didn't really think I had a problem. But that's the way I was living, and I would have continued on that way had not a higher power intervened on my behalf in the form of my daughter, who was in it. She comes over to my house a lot, because her and her boyfriend have a house not too far away. Sometimes they stay over, sometimes they don't. And she saw what I was doing. She was concerned enough to call a guy in AA, a guy that had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 25 years. She said he needs help. So then a weird sequence of events happens, because I knew this guy for a long time. He was a friend of the family. And I knew he was an AA. He was a good guy. A lot of respect for him. But I had no interest in AA. So she calls him. And it was one of those mornings. I knew I'd been on a run, I thought, for 3 or 4 days. And so I wake up in the morning thinking it's Monday. And I go, man, you know, I got drunk all weekend. What an idiot. I'm never going to do that again. I go out to get the newspaper in the driveway. And it's Friday. Oops. I don't have those days. I was just drunk the whole time. So I'm standing in my kitchen pondering the folly of my ways, and the doorbell rings, and it's this guy, this AA guy. And I didn't know he was coming over, but I knew why he was there. And he said, can I come in? And I said, yeah. And he says, you want to talk? And I said, yeah, I do. And we talked for 3 hours. For some reason, that morning, I told him everything that I had been doing. And he told me everything that he had done before he got to AA. He told me his whole story. And I told him mine. And he says, well, here's some options. You can keep on going like you're going. Try going to AA on your own. You don't seem like you did real well in that. You go to an outpatient program, or you can go to an inpatient program. I said, what do you think I should do? And he said, I think you should go inpatient. I think you should go now. And he was right. Because if he had come the day before when I was still screwed up, I would have told him to get the hell off my property. And if he'd come the day after when I was feeling a little better, I'd say, thanks, but no thanks. I'm good. But he came on the right day. Or I said, I'm going to do whatever you think is best. And that's what happened. He pulled some strings, and he got me into a rehab the next day. This was a Friday. He got me into a rehab up in Angels Camp on Saturday. And before I went up there, I called my younger brother and told him what I was doing. And he's been in the program for 23 years now, 22 years of time. Been in AA for that length of time. And he never talked to me about drinking. I never asked him about drinking. But I called him that day and told him, hey, I'm going to rehab. And he told me, okay, that's what you need to do. But here's the thing. When you get up there, check your ego at the door, check your attitude at the door, and check your expectations at the door. Be quiet and do what they tell you to do. And if you can do that, it will be the best decision you've ever made in your life. And that's exactly what I did. And that's exactly what it was. Because that place I went to is a boot camp for AA. Every counselor in there was an AA member. They didn't beat the drum for AA, but that's what the program was. So for 16 hours every day, we did AA stuff. We read the book. We talked about the steps. We had writing assignments. We did other touchy-feely kind of crap, but mostly what we did was AA stuff. We did, man. Some stuff was pretty goofy, but I did it anyway. They had this one exercise where they go, okay, pick the person in this group, and there's like 18 people in the group, pick the person in this group that's least like you, and that you know the least about. So I picked this little guy, he's like 19 or 20, he's got like 55 piercings, and he's a drug guy. I don't do drugs, never did a drug in my life. I'm a booze guy, I'm a straight booze guy. So I picked him. And that was dumb, because what they have you do is you sit in a chair, you sit in chairs with your knees touching, and you stare in the other guy's eyes for 5 minutes. And then you talk about what you experienced and what places it took you. I'm a 55-year-old drunk, man. And so I'm just hoping they don't call on me. We go around the room to share about the experience. Because people are going like, I saw my grandfather. And I went back to when I was a child and when we were fishing. I'm looking at them like, what? So they do call. They call on me. I go, hey, I'm sorry. I couldn't get into it, you know, because I'm just staring at this guy in the world I come from. If you stare at another guy's face for that long, you're probably looking for a fight. So I didn't go anywhere, man. I stayed right here. Well, Mark, we appreciate your candor. That's good. That's good. But anyway, I got out of there, and of course the first thing I do is go to AA, because they tell you, hey, this is just a prep for getting into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got out of there on a Sunday, and I came home to Visalia, and 2 hours later I was in a meeting. And I did the 90 meetings in 90 days, because that's what my sponsor told me to do. He's the guy that 12-stepped me, ended up being my first sponsor. I did everything he told me to do. He said, do 90 meetings in 90 days. I did 209. He said, get a service position. The second month I was sober, I started doing literature Sunday night meeting. This program has saved my life. It's changed my life. I worked the 12 steps with my sponsor. I went through the book paragraph by paragraph, and I got over all the hurdles that had blocked me from this program before. I tried doing AA on my own, and I couldn't get the God thing. Well, neither could Bill W. when he first started. He was an agnostic just like I was. And what people told him was, just keep an open mind. Just open your mind enough to accept the possibility that there might be a power greater than yourself. And just keep working on that and it'll come. Because Bill W., you know, his thing was, his guy was in the hospital 3 times. The doctors in the hospital told him this is what alcoholism is, it's a disease, it's an allergy, and he knew all that stuff and he still drank. He got fired from every job he ever had because he was drunk and he still drank. His wife threatened to leave him and he still drank. And the only thing that kept him from drinking, that allowed him to stop drinking with peace in his heart, was when he had a spiritual experience. That's what this program's all about, and that's what it's been about for me. Once I could take those steps with my sponsor and get over those hurdles blocking me from that higher power, the rest of it was okay. I lived the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still go to 15 meetings a week. I got 4 service commitments, and I love it. Because growing up with alcohol involved in every social activity and every fun activity. I was really afraid of quitting drinking forever because I didn't think I'd be able to have any fun anymore. And I was wrong. It is a lot of fun. There's all kinds of stuff going on in AA. If you're looking to have a good time in AA, sign up for this meeting. This meeting's a good deal. Or go down to Central Office. You know, we got stuff going all the time. The 20th of this month, we got the Sober Fest going over there at the Christ Lutheran Church, at the barbecue, at the speaker meeting. We got a Back to the 40s program coming up in November. So if you haven't taken the 12 steps or you want a refresher, you can do that. It's a good deal. It's a good time. Most of the people I hang out with, really, except for family, are in AA. It's given me a completely new life. I haven't had a drink for a year and 10 months. I haven't thought about it. I don't care about it. It's not part of my life. I've been completely relieved of the obsession to drink because of this program. There's a saying, God got me to AA, which I believe he did in the form of that 12-step call, and AA got me to God, because that's the way I live now. I read spiritual books. I pray every day. I would not go to bed at night before doing a 10th step and praying and thanking God for another day and thanking him for keeping me sober for another day. I take no credit for my sobriety because I tried on my own and it failed utterly. But once I accepted that higher power, God has allowed me to stay sober and to have a happy life. And I'm forever grateful for that. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you for letting me share.